This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, when videos go viral, what happens to the real people who are catapulted into instant infamy? We'll look at the power of social media and its real-world consequences with our guest and your input. Now, in a highly anticipated decision, the Food and Drug Administration, for the very first time this week, gave approval for several e-cigarette products to remain on the market. Now, this comes amid years of concern around e-cigarettes or vaping devices enticing and threatening the health of young people. And the FDA reasons the products it approved are less appealing to youth and could be less hazardous pathway for adults trying to cut back on their addiction to traditional cigarettes. We'd like to hear from you today if you've tried e-cigs or vaping, or if you've tried to quit and can't find yourself a way, or if you have found the way to drop nicotine as a physically addictive substance. Tell us about it. 1-800-642-1234. One of your kids or grandkids used one of these products? 1-800-642-1234. You can join us on our Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Dr. Michael Fiore. He is University of Wisconsin-Hilldale Professor of Medicine. He founded and is the director of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. He's also a general internist and preventative medicine specialist and treats patients for tobacco dependence. Dr. Fiore, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much.
Let's start with this FDA decision, and from the looks of it, it looks like they decided on the products of one major tobacco company while leaving another major tobacco company undecided for the time being. What is your takeaway of what the FDA authorized this week?
Well, first, I think it will be really helpful to state exactly what the FDA said. And what that was is that R.J. Reynolds can market as a tobacco product one of their e-cigarette products called Vuse. So what the FDA did not do is to say Vuse is a medicine. It did not say Vuse is approved as safe and effective. But rather, it said that R.J. Reynolds could market Vuse as a tobacco product. And the reason that the FDA did that is that their analysis of the data said that Vuse, an e-cigarette, when compared to a conventional cigarette, which we often refer to as a combustible cigarette, where we light it, we cause the production of 7,000 chemicals, 50 of which are carcinogens, they determined that Vuse is substantially less harmful than burning cigarettes, so that if you switch from conventional cigarettes to Vuse, it's probably safer. But an important distinction is probably safer does not mean 100% safe.
And what's the perspective of the director of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention following the FDA's decision this week?
Well, there's two things we think a lot about when we think about e-cigarettes. And the first, of course, is kids. We don't want any child, any adolescent, any young adult to use any tobacco product that contains nicotine, pure and simple. Whether it is cigarettes, whether it is e-cigarettes, or whether it's smokeless tobacco products. And why do we take this perspective? Because we know that the adolescent brain is incredibly malleable, that nicotine damages that adolescent brain, and it puts kids at risk for lifelong addiction, including progressing from e-cigarettes to cigarettes that we burn, combustible cigarettes or conventional cigarettes that are harmful. So that's one thing totally clear. We don't want any kids to be using any tobacco product. But we have to balance that against the fact that in the United States, we've got 35 million people addicted to conventional cigarettes. And we know if they don't quit or switch their product, half of them are going to be killed by their addiction to cigarettes, on average dying 10 years more prematurely, often from horrible cancers, heart disease, and lung disease. So it's a real balance. On the one hand, we've got to protect kids. But on the other hand, we've got to come up with more and effective ways to help the 35 million Americans, including about 700,000 here in Wisconsin, help them to quit so they don't suffer and die.
700,000 smokers in Wisconsin?
Yes, there are. And those are all at risk. So think about that. About 350,000 of them are going to die prematurely if they don't quit. It's a giant public health problem.
Dr. Michael Fiore is the director of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. And if you've got a story about the physical addiction of nicotine, we'll hear from you this afternoon at 1-800-642-1234. So this may go to the FDA's authorization of the sale of these Vuse e-cigarettes and the mandate that they be tobacco flavored, right? That the tobacco flavoring is in some way intended to avoid the enticement of children and yet allow for those who are using combustible cigarettes to move towards an e-cig. Did I get that right, doctor?
Well, yes, you did. And what the FDA said in its release of October 12th was that flavorings make e-cigarettes particularly appealing to young people. Therefore, flavored views, whether it's bubble gum or mint or mango or any of the myriad of flavors that these companies have used, are banned. What they can do is sell it flavored as tobacco. So it's very similar to the experience that an addicted smoker has when smoking a conventional cigarette. And what we know based upon the research that was presented to the FDA is that young people are less likely to smoke these tobacco-flavored e-cigarettes. It doesn't mean that they won't smoke them at all, but they're less likely to smoke them. So they did this balance, this determination of what, you know, we've got two difficult challenges here, and how do we balance it? And that's what the FDA is trying to do.
So in the past months leading up to Tuesday's decision from the Food and Drug Administration on the use of e-cigs, the FDA has ordered thousands of vaping products off of the store shelves. Is that as a result of the flavoring that's been used? What was behind that decision?
So just to give a little history, 10 years ago, we didn't have any e-cigarettes. So these are all new products. And frankly, the government and the FDA has struggled with how do we deal with all of these new products that kids in particular seem to gravitate towards. So what they did was to use some existing regulatory authority and say that every company that is selling e-cigarettes needs to present data to the FDA, present evidence that says we're not hooking kids and these products aren't appealing to kids. What they found is that so many of these e-cigarette companies were just making kid-like flavors, whether they be bubblegum or any of the other ones that we've all heard about and seen, often looking like candy, and said all of those are banned. There's a couple companies that are proposing to market e-cigarettes in a way that is less appealing to children. Doesn't say zero appeal, just less appealing to children. And Vuse tobacco-flavored e-cigarettes is one example, and in fact, the first one that the FDA has authorized for use.
Dr. Fiore, since the decision on Tuesday from the FDA focuses on tobacco-flavored Vuse e-cigarettes, which comes from the tobacco company R.J. Reynolds, where does this leave the other another major tobacco company, Altria, which owns, as I understand, about a third of the e-cigarette known as Juul?
Yep, really important information that's not yet been released by the FDA. Altria and Juul have submitted to the FDA their packet of information requesting permission to market. I suspect over the next few months we'll hear from the FDA what their judgment is regarding Juul. But I suspect we'll also see something very similar to what we've seen with Vuse in this R.J. Reynolds product. I don't envision there's going to be any flavored e-cigarettes that are received permission for marketing, but we'll have to see what the FDA says. I sure don't have any inside knowledge about that, but based upon this this report that was released, I think it does provide what we'll probably see with the other large companies. And of course, everyone, just as you've said, is waiting to hear what will happen with Juul, because Juul was so popular with kids. Importantly, Juul and all of the other major e-cigarette companies have stopped selling flavored e-cigarettes already. So that's already happened.
A roadmap for regulation when it comes to e-cigarettes. New decision on Tuesday from the FDA may lead to what lies ahead for other vape products and e-cigarettes. And we're talking with Dr. Michael Fiore. He's the director of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. We're looking at the FDA's decision this week to approve some of these e-cigarette products, and we want to hear from you. What do you think about what the FDA had to say? What do you think about nicotine products and the 700,000 estimated Wisconsinites who partake in them, and the consequences for them and for our community, all of us? How were you able to quit smoking? I used nicotine lozenges for years. Hear from you today still at 1-800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and this is the Ideas Network. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with Dr. Michael Fiore, the director of the University of Wisconsin Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. We're talking about e-cigarettes and the FDA's approval on Tuesday of certain products, allowing them to remain on the market and to be marketed. Not to children, of course. Let's go to Bob in Cross Plains, who joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Bob.
Hi. Well, hi. Thanks for the call. So, my question is, what's going to happen? Is there a way, end way around this, that maybe the industry is going to create flavors that they can then, the individuals can add to the tobacco or to the e-cigarette, so it's not being sold that way, but you buy the e-cigarette and then you buy a bubblegum flavor and you mix them together? What, any conditions or restrictions on that?
Interesting. Dr. Fiore, is there a way that tobacco companies will try to get around the new regulations?
Well, that's clearly a concern, and it's particularly a concern with some of the vaping shops that often do the mixing right there and then in your presence. It's also the concern with some of other products that people mix at home. The hope is that these are sealed products that don't allow for their manipulation. You know, folks may remember, it was only 2 years ago when we had an epidemic of something called EVOLI, when kids primarily were adding products to their e-cigarettes that caused incredible lung damage. And many young people died. Others were debilitated because of damage to their lungs. So the concern raised by our caller is a real one. But if it is a sealed product, then hopefully it cannot be manipulated.
The American Lung Association, in response to the FDA's decision this week, said the harm that these products cause to youth shows that they failed to meet the Tobacco Control Act's public health standard, implying that the FDA's decision somehow goes against the law. And again, it goes back to that balance, Dr. Fiore, and how we find that balance. Does some of the answer have to do with the marketing rules that were put in place this week and who will see or have available these e-cigs?
Yeah, and of course, very reasonable people have different perspectives on the FDA's rulings. But importantly, as part of the ruling, what they have stated they are going to do is review marketing materials on a regular basis. And if, in fact, R.J. Reynolds is marketing these products in a way that makes them particularly appealing to children, as per the FDA's judgment, they will withdraw this approval. So that is part of the materials that was released by the FDA. And I want to just take a moment to use this as an opportunity, particularly for all of our listeners, to highlight the following. We have treatments that we know help people to quit. If you smoke combustible cigarettes, conventional cigarettes, and you want to quit, and you don't want to use these cigarettes, and as a physician, that would not be the product that I would direct you to use. You have the following resources available to you. The Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW is a free counseling service available to everybody in our state. Already 250,000 individuals have called to get help. And not only do we provide counseling, we run this through the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line and the Wisconsin Health Department, but we also provide 2 weeks of free nicotine medicine. Just call and you'll get it mailed to your home.
1-800-QUIT-NOW?
1-800-QUIT-NOW. You'll get both counseling and 2 weeks of free medicine. You could talk to your doctor because there are seven medicines that the FDA has said are safe and effective to help you to quit. There are five that are nicotine medicines. There's in two pills, one varenicline and one bupropion. And finally, you could go on to the National Cancer Institute's website, smokefree.gov, so www.smokefree.gov, and you can get help to quit online, including text-based programs based on the type of person you are and the product that you're using. So there are resources out there. You don't have to turn to e-cigarettes. You can use products that we know are supported by science and are also safe and effective. So I, as a physician and as the director of the Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, say loud and clear, take advantage of what we know works. And I want to tell you one last resource, and that is the website we have here at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. It's www.ctri.wisc.edu. And in addition to all these other resources I've mentioned to you, we have research studies where we will help you to quit, and you could participate in advancing the science at the same time.
Dr. Fiore, and while it's only anecdotal, as a former smoker, I have not come across any longtime smokers who were not interested in quitting. It's just not something that I've come across.
And I agree with you wholeheartedly. Yeah. Most people who smoke today feel like they've got a monkey on their back. They became addicted as children. They want to quit. Often they've tried and have failed, and I say, don't give up. We have treatments. The more times you try, the more likely you ought to quit.
Right. Don't
use
quit
one
quitting.
Of the medicines. call 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
And listen, doctor, we have actually compiled all of these resources on our website, thanks to the Central Time team for putting it all together. If you missed any of what Dr. Fiore had to offer for your steps to smoking cessation, that would not include e-cigs, because that would not be, according to a medical practitioner, the best way. You can go to WPR.org/Central Time. We'll have the phone number, we'll have the website, we'll have the resources for you to get started. Just don't quit quitting, and that would be the step forward. Speaking of steps forward, though, with a few minutes we have left, Dr. Fiore, what's next for the FDA and their tobacco division?
Well, you know, we know that smoking is going to kill half of the people who continue doing it. And we got to do everything we can to reduce and eliminate tobacco use. And one authority that the FDA has that they've not yet used, that I hope they will soon, is to mandate the removal of nicotine from all tobacco products to non-addictive levels. That's one of their authorities, maybe for another time to discuss it. But boy, we know that people don't smoke denicotinized cigarettes. Thus, we have a way out of this dilemma and a way to save a 500,000 lives per year.
What about, and we've talked a lot about the flavor of e-cigarettes, but also the flavor of combustible cigarettes. What about menthol?
Well, part of the FDA's current authority is to ban menthol. They've not yet taken that and utilized that authority.
So we'll keep an eye on it and keep in touch with you. Dr. Fiore, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to talk. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Dr. Michael Fiore directs the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, which he founded. Coming up, ever wonder what happened to that person you watched over and over in that viral video that everybody else has seen? How strange your life can get after you've gone viral. We'll explore what happens in the wake of internet infamy. You can probably guess, and it ain't too pretty. I'm Lee Rayburn. You're listening to Central Time and on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and join us on Monday starting at 3 when Central Time gets the latest on the labor strikes that are making headlines across the country and the story behind them. We'll also investigate the disconnect between warehouse jobs and the lack of workers willing to take them on. Plus, we'll tackle our own biases with the author of the new book, The End of Bias, A Beginning. Now, many of us have seen viral videos online, and maybe you remember the Charlie Bit My Finger video or the Double Rainbow Guy.
Oh my God, it's full on Double Rainbow all the way across the sky. Oh my God.
Just sheer joy. And by now, you might know what the going viral part looks like, too. The video gets shared thousands, maybe millions of times. It turns into a meme, a GIF or GIF if you choose. Someone remixes it and turns it into a song. We all have an opinion about it. But it's real still, right? What happens to those ordinary people who overnight find themselves the focus of the entire internet? It's something our next guest has been taking a closer look at, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Your favorite viral video moments on the internet? Have you shared a viral video you thought was funny? Have you become internet famous? And what was the aftermath like for you or somebody you know? A friend, perhaps. 1-800-642-1234 is the phone number to join us, or you can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. Rebecca Jennings is a senior reporter at Vox. And Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there have been so many examples of viral videos. There's basically a new one a day for us to chew on and figure out why it is so fascinating for us. But the latest one you wrote about happened on TikTok. And for folks my age and older or even younger, it may not be the social media that they are checking out every day. So for the uninitiated like myself, how would you describe TikTok, Rebecca?
Yeah, absolutely. So TikTok is sort of something you open on your phone and immediately you're just kind of plunged into an infinite scroll of short videos under 3 minutes. And so you can theoretically be scrolling for hours without realizing that any time has gone by because the algorithm with which it uses to determine what videos you see is tailored to you and to your taste. So it's very addicting. It's very fun. And people can go viral very, very quickly there, even when they have no followers, which is why we're getting so much more viral content from normal people.
Like the couch guy. Now, perhaps if you're not on TikTok, you've seen it. But what I've noticed is whether you're on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, these TikTok videos are making the rounds on all of social media. So maybe you have seen the couch guy. But if you haven't, Rebecca Jennings, give us the Cliff Notes version of this brief video that went viral.
Yeah, so this was posted by a college student named Lauren. She was making a video surprising her boyfriend at college. They're long distance. And so it's a typical supposed to be like cute moment video. She has her friend filming her walking into this room with all these people and her boyfriend's there and he's really surprised and he gets up and hugs her. You know, it was supposed to be, you know, a typical sweet video. But commenters started noticing that the guy didn't look exactly that thrilled that she was there. And also he was sitting on a couch with like two other girls and people thought that was suspicious. And so it became this whole thing where everyone was like, dump him. Like, he doesn't love you. Like, you know, it was pretty rough. And then since then, they've all kind of been dealing with the fallout from that, everyone thinking their relationship is a sham.
I watched the video and my first thought is, why did this go viral? What was it that vaulted this to everybody's attention?
Yeah, it's because it like people have been treating it like sort of like a true crime documentary, like analyzing the evidence as though they're like detectives. And I think that's what the thrill that people get out of it. They're like, oh, I can tell that, you know, the other girl had her arm around him and he was like handing his phone back to her or something. And, you know, people just got all these wild conspiracy theories about it.
So the video, the viral video is one thing, but then the videos that it creates, these reaction videos dissecting the original TikTok frame by frame, as you mentioned, like a true crime story. And here's one of those reaction videos.
I don't want to talk about this guy on the couch, except to say there are worse things than being single. I want to talk about these girls on the couch because these girls are not your friend. And before you say, oh, you don't even know them. I know them. We all know them.
So Couch Guy's got a name. His name is Robbie, and he was in a relationship before this video went viral, and everybody had something to say about Robbie and his significant other. What's the real ramifications of this viral experience?
I mean, it's funny because everybody that was sort of in the video has now been sort of documenting what it's been like in their own TikToks, and Robbie's roommate made a video being like, they're in college. And so he was like, we keep getting notes slipped under our door and people keep coming to our door and wanting to talk to him. And, you know, it just felt really weird. And Robbie himself posted a video being like, you guys are being parasocial creeps. You know, not everything is true crime. Not everything is drama. And they just seem a little shaken by it. Although there are t-shirts, I think, being sold. I think Lauren is selling Couch Guy t-shirts, so as well get some money out of it. I don't.
There's a distinction. I mean, we've seen like Rebecca Black went viral with her video for Friday, and that was almost if not a decade ago already. We've seen others who have like on American Idol who have become popular through cringe content. But these are ordinary people living ordinary lives that are captured in ordinary ways that then get spiral out of control. Is there a way to control this with still being social on social media, Rebecca?
Certainly not on platforms like TikTok, because, you know, the thing about TikTok is because normal people can go viral so fast, like if they happen to have a video that, you know, hits the right demographic or whatever, you know, you cannot control it. Like, you know, you can sure delete the video, make it private, whatever, but like, it happens so much faster there than it would on Twitter or Instagram or YouTube, where, you know, people work for years to develop big followings and, you know, virality is kind of hard to come by on those platforms. But on TikTok, it's everywhere. And so, you know, it's just going to become more and more likely that you yourself, like everybody on the internet, is eventually going to become what's known as like the main character of the day. And usually that's not a very good thing to be.
the main character of the day. Rebecca Jennings is our guest. She's a senior reporter at Vox. She has been studying this in a way that goes beyond the viral video and hits the real people who are becoming these characters of the day, but they're still real people at the end of the day. And how do you reconcile these two things together really is the question. 1-800-642-1234. If you've got some sort of answer or understanding of it. I also want to talk about, as you call it, cringe TikTok. Rebecca, how would you describe cringe TikTok?
Cringe TikTok is basically like someone posting something on the internet, expecting to garner one reaction and getting sort of the opposite, or getting something that was totally unintended. So maybe someone trying to be cute or hot and then end up being like, you feel embarrassed for them because they didn't quite get there and for whatever reason. Or in Lauren's case, you know, posting this video of her surprising her boyfriend, she would hope that, you know, it would be really sweet. She put like a cute romantic song behind it. And then everyone was like, actually, your boyfriend hates you. And it's like, okay. Yeah. And so a lot of TikTok is like that. Like every few scrolls, I watch a video and I'm like, not really sure why this showed up on my For You page. And then I look at the comments and they're like all just like roasting the poster. So it's sort of like a blood sport, to be honest. It's really kind of scary.
Yeah, if you're not a social media gladiator, it sounds downright mean and nasty.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it absolutely can be. I've talked to people that have gone viral like this, and I think it can be a little traumatizing. And you know, in the best case scenario, it's like if you can laugh it off, that's great. But you know, not everybody can do that. So yeah.
One of these viral video real people that you talked to was a recent grad of Columbia. She was a theater graduate from Columbia who put out her song New York Summer and then put out a viral video about how nobody was listening to her new song New York Summer, and then everybody listened to it because it became cringe TikTok.
Yes, exactly. And so she made this joke video being like, oh, no one's listening to my song. And then people found, she like played the song in the TikTok. And so people were like, this song is actually like terrible. But like, you know, it and like, you know, she's been a good sport about it. But like, she told me, she was like, I thought that this was a good song. Like, I didn't think that it was going to, you know, turn against me like that. But you know, she's at the end of the day, she's getting attention and she got followers from it. And so she said she's hoping that, you know, that can turn into something that she can use in the future. So, you know,
maybe something a little more palatable for myself would be the parody cringe TikTok, folks going on social media in the effort to make, you know, make light of themselves or others, but in a lighthearted way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's always really fun to watch. So it's people like sort of doing, you know, a meta joke about someone that would post a cringe TikTok and not know it. So someone, they're even impossible to explain. You kind of just have to know them when you see it. It's just like someone doing something kind of silly or embarrassing, and then. But like, that's the whole point of it.
Yes,
like
they're trying to do it. And those that aren't trying, it makes your muscles tighten in a way that makes you cringe, that helps explain why you call it cringe TikTok. But the parody allows, at least hopefully, allows us to laugh at ourselves to some degree.
Exactly. Yeah. But, I mean, all this stuff is just a mirror to our own shame and our own like feelings about being people. So, you know.
Yes, exactly. Rebecca Jennings is a senior reporter at Vox, and perhaps this goes beyond the viral videos into how we see ourselves or the blind spots we have about ourselves until we put ourselves out there, and the courage it takes to put yourself out there. We want to hear from you still when it comes to going viral and being real at 1-800-642-1234, parodying the cringe or being cringe TikTok. When do the lines get blurry between cruelty and comedy? 1-800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and let's pick up on our conversation about what happens when everyday people go viral online. Our guest, Rebecca Jennings from Vox, stays with us, and we want to hear from you and your thoughts, questions, experiences about social media. how social or antisocial it could be, 1-800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us as well at ideas@WPR.org. So, Rebecca, one of the things you mentioned in your articles is these social media networks like TikTok, they don't have gatekeepers, so anybody can get through. And that can include some folks who are dealing with mental illness. And then the reactions that come about can be sometimes unhelpful to dealing with mental health. And the social media and mental health have certainly reached a nexus most recently with the discussions about what Facebook knows about how children are using it.
Right. And so basically what we have is a lot of people just like seeing, you know, a 30 or 60 second clip of someone's life, you know, and judging based on that and that alone without knowing, you know, what might else be going on in that person's life or what under what like context was that video made, you know, like you don't know what you basically, no one has any idea what they're talking about when all you know is a couple clips, like as like a few seconds of a video, you know?
You've been shown a show. You haven't been shown a person. You've been given a glimpse of a moment in time.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And that's impossible to actually judge. Let's go to Luis in Dodgeville, who has a question for our guest, Rebecca Jennings from Vox. Luis, good afternoon.
Hi. I have a question. I'm just watching the churn of social media, you know, Tumblr and Vine and, you know, ye old MySpace. Facebook, you know, Facebook is kind of like for grandmas now and everyone, you know, is like Instagram, but now TikTok. So I guess what are your thoughts on what's coming next? And has COVID really kind of driven the speed of all this as well? People social distancing. So just curious what your thoughts are.
Rebecca?
Yeah, totally. It's so funny because, you know, I've been on the internet culture beat for a few years now, and I can tell you right away when the pandemic hit, it was taken a lot more seriously. Like I got a lot more readers, a lot more attention on the beat. A lot more people started writing about it. So yes, I think the pandemic sort of made TikTok, for instance, very mainstream in a way that it, you know, it was big, but it was considered, you know, an app for kids, you know. And then once I think a lot of parents and kids were under the same roof again and, you know, spending more time IRL together, you know, you sort of learn what the other is doing online. So there's been a lot more, you know, people are a lot more competent, I think, on the internet and social media than they once were. In terms of what's coming next, I mean, we've kind of been having the same like four social media networks over the past decade, you know, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I think TikTok is now like among that group, you know, and I think because of how much power Facebook especially has, it's not going anywhere. And so, you know, whatever happens with, you know, the antitrust, you know, ongoing saga of whatever, like, is Facebook going to sell off WhatsApp or Instagram? I think like, it's just still going to be these huge, huge companies winning time and time again until there's actually regulation against them. But I think that pandemic especially made TikTok, you know, up there with Twitter, with YouTube, with Facebook, et cetera.
Rebecca Jennings, you have an article at Vox.com about your first foray into TikTok. You first downloaded TikTok in the fall of 2018. And as you write, it only took a few days for the algorithm to figure out that you had ADHD and use that as a jumping off point to investigate how the nexus of social media and mental health, using yourself as an example.
Yeah, so it was really funny because, you know, people joke that the TikTok algorithm knows more about them than they do about themselves because, you know, people have come to all these realizations over the past year and a half, you know, inside exploring TikTok and being like, oh, maybe I'm questioning parts of my gender expression or my sexuality or my mental health, things like that. And so on TikTok especially, and I think on Twitter as well, you're getting so much content that's like, here's how to know if you have X thing. And so I think part of that can be really helpful for people because, you know, they're starting to take their mental health seriously. But another thing it does is just sort of pathologizes everyday normal human behavior. You know, like just because you were distracted, you know, for a few minutes doesn't mean you have ADHD, doesn't mean, you know, something's wrong with your brain. You know, like anxiety is a human feeling that all humans possess. It's only an issue if it gets in the way of you living a happy life. And so these things are a lot more nebulous and a lot more, you know, it's not a binary. It's like, you know, you're not mentally ill or perfectly brain, like perfect brain. So I think it creates a lot of that kind of discourse that gets a little ugly sometimes.
And social media is not a medical professional.
Yes. There are many doctors on there, but it's really hard to tell who's actually a doctor and who's just like wearing a white coat.
Right. You could be anybody online, right?
Right, exactly.
So as you've been so seeped in social media culture, which for many of us became our social world in the pandemic, if you were to start to design what a healthy social media should look like and how we should react or engage with it, you know, where would you even begin, Rebecca?
I think really the problem is scale. You know, like at a certain point, enough users are using your app where you can hire as many people as you want to moderate it and to make and to fix whatever you need to fix on it. But like, it's just never going to be enough because there will always be people just uploading hours and hours and megabytes of content constantly. And in order to sort of weed through all that, you have to use an imperfect robot or AI or algorithm or something like that to sort of sort through it. And those things make mistakes. And so I think the really like, you know, social networks are based on what humans like to do. And I think they amplify a lot of the bad things about the human brain. but yeah, I literally think it's a problem of scale. I think, you know, niche social networks are ones that can absolutely work. But when we're talking about something with the scale of a TikTok or an Instagram or a Facebook, it's just really, really kind of impossible to make it, there is obviously like a lot of things that Mark Zuckerberg et al. Can be doing, but we're never going to have a utopia on a social network that is made up of millions of people.
Rebecca Jennings is a senior reporter at Vox. And so if we were, for those who want to put themselves out there, but fear what the bullying would be like, for fear of being cringe TikTok, do you have any advice for content creators?
I mean, to be a content creator, you kind of just got to make content. But I think if you don't put your face in it as much, at least, you know, it doesn't have the power to like make you a laughing stock of just like seeing you at the grocery store. You know, if you want to be a content creator, but you don't really want that kind of public attention. Yeah. Like don't show your face in it because that's a really good way to, have a lot of anxiety about going out in public.
Yeah. Does content moderation then, is that something that could be implemented? And you say it's a matter of scale. If we had smaller social networks, would we have more moderation? If we had more moderation, would we have less bullying? Is there any healthy way to move forward with social media?
I mean, I think just like sort of limiting the amount of time that you spend on it. And it's funny for me to say that because I've spent like all day.
That's a job.
I think going outside is very helpful and, you know, engaging in things with real life, if you're able to, whenever possible is, you know, it's just better. And I sound like, you know, a pioneer when I say that, but like, or like a pilgrim or something, but.
What about the idea of creating, mandating real identities for personas online? It's something that I think Facebook tried to some degree and found it could be as damaging as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think that is a really, really tough question because, you know, if everything's real identities, you know, people who are, you know, working, people of all kinds of situations, whether they're, you know, whether they want to find community and who are gay and can't come out or like they're being victims of domestic assault and they have like their real name attached to something. There's no anonymity for people who desperately need safety and who can only find it online to have that. And on the other hand, you know, you can be whoever you want to be online, which obviously can start a lot of horribleness as well. So yeah, it's not, I think it's good that there are multiple social networks for in different levels of anonymity. You know, like you can go on Reddit and be completely anonymous, whereas on something like Facebook or Instagram, you're probably not going to be anonymous.
So my social media would be on Twitter, and I want to run this rule of thumb by you, Rebecca Jennings, before we're done today. The best tweet to post is the one you never send.
Yeah, I mean, I love looking at people's like unsent tweets, like their drafts. It's comedic gold. But yeah, I think the best tweet is, the best rule is just to never tweet, because then you don't have to engage in the awful dynamics of Twitter.
Rebecca Jennings, senior reporter at Vox, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Weekdays from 6 to 9, it's the morning show. Don't miss it. Monday after 7, it's your State Capitol Report with the Secretary-Designee of Workforce Development, Wisconsin, Amy Pahacek, and the State Secretary of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, Randy Romanski. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then the legacy of Wisconsin's Indian boarding schools, the family separation policy that Governor Evers apologized for on Monday, Indigenous Peoples Day, and the next steps forward for some semblance of healing with two guests from our Native nations. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time.